This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Prosecutors say the arrest of a Coast Guard officer on gun and drug offenses last week was the proverbial tip of the iceberg. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has details.
According to court papers, prosecutors say U.S. Coast Guard Lieutenant Christopher Paul Hassan, who was arrested last week, is a domestic terrorist. Prosecutors write in court papers that Hassan drafted an email discussing biological attacks, and he had what appeared to be a hit list that named prominent Democrats and media figures. Court papers detail a June 2017 email where Hassan wondered about acquiring anthrax and described a bombing or sniper attacks. Hassan, who works at the Coast Guard headquarters in Washington, is due to appear in federal court in Maryland Thursday. Mike Gracia, Washington.
U.S. President Donald Trump said on Wednesday it will be totally up to the new attorney general when and how to release the special counsel's Russian investigation report. His remark to reporters in the Oval Office came just after CNN reported the completion of Robert Mueller's investigation could come as early as next week. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports an organization that tracks white supremacists and other far-right extremists have discovered more.
The Southern Poverty Law Center says it counted some 1,020 hate groups operating in the United States last year, the highest level in more than two decades. The organization says the number reflects what it describes as an enlivened and growing American hate movement.
That's AP's Ben Thomas reporting. U.S.-backed forces are one step closer to liberating the last patch of Syrian territory held by the Islamic State terror group, but a final assault could still be days away. The coalition statement came hours after the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces broke a stalemate with IS fighters still holed up in the village of Baghouz, securing the release of hundreds of civilians, including women and children. Witnesses said they saw a convoy of about 10 trucks leave Islamic State's last enclave. This is VOA News. House Democrats are making an official move to try to block President Trump's efforts to use a national security emergency declaration to get border wall funding. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Congressional aides have told progressive-leaning groups that a resolution will be filed on Friday, challenging President Trump's plan and setting up a potential showdown over billions of dollars, immigration policy, and the constitutional separation of powers. The resolution would go to the Republican-controlled Senate, where passage is unlikely. Senator Susan Collins of Maine, a moderate Republican, has announced she will support the resolution to block the emergency declaration. Outside groups, including the ACLU, are also suing. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
The Trump administration has imposed sanctions on Indian nationals Jasmeet Hakimzada, declaring him a major foreign drug trafficker. Hakimzada lives in the United Arab Emirates. He's accused of running a worldwide drug trafficking ring that smuggles heroin, cocaine, opioids, and other substances into the United States, Australia, Britain, and New Zealand. Six other people and entities were also sanctioned, including Hakimzada's parents, who all allegedly helped him run his operation. An Alabama woman who joined the Islamic State group in Syria wants to come back to the United States, but the Trump administration says she cannot. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
Hoda Muthana says she made a big mistake by leaving the U.S. to join Islamic State militants nearly 4 years ago after being radicalized online. The 24-year-old says she wants to come home with the 18-month-old son she had with one of two fighters she married. But Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says Muthana will not be admitted to the U.S. He says she is not an American citizen, has no legal basis to claim citizenship or the right to a passport. Pompeo did not say how the government decided Muthana, who was born in New Jersey, cannot return to the U.S. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A new flare-up of fighting in South Sudan violates the country's peace agreement. The United States and European allies are demanding the clashes end immediately. A joint statement Wednesday from the U.S., Britain, and Norway says that the fighting around a town of Yi represents a flagrant breach of a December 2017 ceasefire and the revitalized peace deal. American businessman Michael Calvi, who was detained in Moscow 5 days ago on fraud charges, has not yet had consular access, according to the head of a U.S.-Russian trade organization. According to terms of the Vienna Convention, consular access must be provided within a 72-hour window from the time of arrest. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Thursday, February 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A new study highlights increasing abortions from rape in Cameroon's conflict zones.
We know that rape is today a weapon of war, and many thousands of women have had to flee and are today even more vulnerable to sexual abuse.
Allegra Bauchi is the coordinator of the UN system in Cameroon. A Rwandan court rules that the auction of the Rigara family company property was legal. South Sudan parties react to a UN report on worsening human rights abuses despite a peace agreement. And former President Kabila's coalition pledged to uphold internal cohesion and recognize Mr. Kabila as the moral authority of the coalition.
We need cohesion, we need unity, we need to have the same cadre under the rule of our moral authority, former President Kabila.
Andre Alain Atundo is the spokesman for former DRC President Kabila's former ruling coalition. Zimbabwe cancels this year's International Art Festival, and Malawi's albinos seek asylum to escape attacks. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A new study says rape is not only a weapon of war in Cameroon's separatist conflict, but also that many victims are terminating pregnancies with crude, unsafe abortion techniques. Moki Edwin Kizeka talked with the teens who escaped to safe areas and files this report.
It is 7:30 a.m., breakfast time at the residence of Pastor Grace Mengo of Divine Redemption Ministries in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. The pastor lost her husband 3 months ago and says she is a struggling single mother of one. She is also feeding 2 additional mouths, that of a one-month-old baby girl and the baby's 16-year-old mother, Mercy Azefo. She says she took in Azefo, a rape victim, because the teenager had nowhere else to go after fleeing from the town of Nkambe.
She has not been eating well, so she was very slim. So I looked for some old dresses. I gave her. This child was really, really, really desperate. Today like this, I don't know any member of her family.
Nkambe is in the northwest region, one of 2 areas where English-speaking separatist groups are fighting to break away from Cameroon and its French-speaking majority. Azefo says she was raped in Nkambe while hiding on her mother's farm after her parents were killed in April 2018. She says a family running from the fighting drove her to Yaoundé, where she met Mengo and delivered a baby girl 2 months ago.
I gave her the name Gracious because she's all that I have. I don't want her to go through what I went through. She will certainly have good education and help others tomorrow. She knows no other father than God who created her.
Azefo is not the only teenage mother of an unknown rapist. A Cameroonian non-profit group, the Rural Women's Center for Education and Development, says it is keeping track of at least 300 school-age girls from the northwest region who became pregnant as a result of rape, either from suspected separatist fighters or government soldiers. Vera Wisi, coordinator of the center, says they were motivated to carry out the study after a 14-year-old rape victim came to a hospital in the northwest town of Ndop and asked that her 6-month pregnancy be terminated.
A young girl came to do an abortion. The medical personnel tried to find out what happened. She told him the community is not safe, gunshot. Her grandmother is not able to take care of her. The guy impregnated her and ran.
Wisi says at least 130 of the 300 girls they met had already had abortions, with some using crude traditional means that endangered their lives. Panje Roland of Cameroon's Ministry of Women Empowerment says many more women and girls in the northwest and southwest regions have been victims of sexual exploitation. He says it is difficult to know their numbers because many are still hiding in the bushes. In December last year, Allegra Baoshi, coordinator of the UN system in Cameroon, called for the protection of women and girls in the war zone and a stop to what she called humiliating practices.
We know that rape is today a weapon of war, and many thousands of women have had to flee and are today even more vulnerable to sexual abuse.
A report last year by rights group Amnesty International criticized both the Cameroon military and separatists for abuses on civilians. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Former DRC President Joseph Kabila's once ruling coalition on Wednesday signed an agreement pledging to uphold internal cohesion and recognize Mr. Kabila as the moral authority of the coalition. The once ruling Common Front for Congo coalition holds the majority of seats in the Congolese parliament as a result of last December's presidential election. The agreement came a few days after former President Kabila held talks with President Felix Tshisekedi. André Alain Atundu, a spokesman for former President Kabila's once ruling coalition. He denies the agreement was an attempt to prevent members of the former ruling coalition from defecting to President Tshisekedi's ruling coalition.
The agreement turned around three main points. First of all, this chart was to transform our electoral coalition to a governmental one. So we are now a political and governmental coalition. Secondly, it was to confirm the loyalty and the fidelity to President Kabila, who is our moral authority. So to confirm his leadership on our group. And third, they committed not to bring to the court our electoral disputes in order to safeguard our internal cohesion between the member of FCC.
This agreement came a few days after President Tshisekedi met with President Kabila. Tell me, is this agreement that was signed within the Kabila coalition, was it signed just to put members on record so that no one will defect to the Tshisekedi side?
I think we are in a positive mind. This is a negative one. This is to ensure the efficiency of our political action. We need coalition, cohesion, we need unity, we need to have the same target under the rule of our moral authority from the President Kabila. So the objective is not against President Tshisekedi or against someone. Our internal concern, we have to have success, we have to keep together to safeguard our unity, our internal coalition, and to recognize formally the leadership of President Kabila, who is our moral authority.
Former President Kabila's coalition, of which you are a member, you won majority of the parliamentary seats during the election last year. Now, according to your laws, the coalition is supposed to put forth a prime minister. The President Kabila discussed that with President Tshisekedi.
President Kabila is the chief of one of the main political forces. There are two main political forces, Kabila coalition and Tshisekedi coalition. So it's logical that in order to govern together, they discuss about how to dispute the ministry. I think it's normal. What's happening now in our country is what happened in the other countries in the world.
André Alain Atundu is a spokesman for former DRC President Joseph Kabila's once ruling coalition. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington today. It's Thursday, February 21st, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 and a half minutes past the hour. A court in Rwanda on Wednesday ruled that the auction of the Rigara Family Tobacco Company property conducted by the Rwanda Revenue Authority was legal. Last year, the Revenue Authority auctioned off machinery, equipment, and stocks belonging to the Premier Tobacco Company to recover over $6.9 million that it said the company owed in taxes. The Rigara family went to court to challenge the auction. As Eugene Uwimana reports from Kigali, the family says the auction was politically motivated.
It took the judge nearly 10 minutes to read the verdict. The court says all the concerns raised by the Rigara Premier Tobacco Company, or PTC, were baseless. Janvier Guagatale, the lawyer for PTC, argued the Rwanda Revenue Authority and Bailiff Vedaste Haimana didn't inform the company nor announce the auction to attract other buyers. After the court's decision, Adeline Rwigara, the mother of Diane, who had owned about 9% of the company's share, say the auction was politically motivated. It is beyond the sadness. Now it's laughable. A country that is said to be democratic, that has to facilitate all its citizens, now is using courts to destabilize people. Everyone sees that this auction or Rwanda Revenue claims are fabricated. Adeline Rwigara said the family will analyze the verdict and explore the options for an appeal. She said the family will not be discouraged. We not lose force in any way. Look the way we are troubled in these 4 years. They have invaded our properties, tied us and imprisoned us. We cannot be discouraged. We have worked hard for what we are fighting for. And we are not strangers. We are Rwandans. The Rwanda Revenue Authority says the only purpose of the auction was to recover the balance on tax areas amounting to 6 billion Rwandan francs, which the company did not pay between 12 and 2017. Even though every property of the Premier Tobacco Company was auctioned off, still the amount realized was not able to cover the tax amount owed by the company. This means that the Rwigara family is likely to see more properties being auctioned to recover the remaining 4 billion Rwandan francs. The Rwigara family problems with the Rwandan government began in 2015 following the death of prominent businessman Rwigara Assinapol in a car accident. His family alleged he was murdered for ending a business relationship with the Rwandan government, thereby falling out of favor with President Paul Kagame. Assinapol Rwigara was a known financier of the ruling Rwandan Patriotic Front Party during and after the Liberation War. His daughter Diane Rwigara tried to run for presidency in 2017, but was barred after being accused of forging her supporters' signatures. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Reactions are mixed from South Sudan's warring parties on the new UN human rights report, in which investigators say they found new evidence of ongoing human rights violations in the country that may constitute war crimes. Ornette Walter Solomon has more from Juba.
The report released documents horrific human rights abuses. Colonel Lampol Gabriel, the SPLAIO's deputy military spokesman, refuses to say whether his group committed human rights violations against civilians. He says the SPLAIO is investigating the alleged human rights abuses on its own and will punish anyone found guilty of committing such violations.
There's a committee being set by our chairman to investigate those alleged that took place. In case we find anyone responsible for these atrocities, he or she will be held responsible immediately.
Lamb says he sees no need for the UN rights body to release such a report at a time when South Sudan's peace partners are busy implementing the revitalized peace deal.
Some suspicion as to whether the human rights or the UN really they have advisory role or they don't have. Or we talk in the same language of peace in this country, all they want is to report negative things. So renewal of investigation is like saying we have failed in our first investigation.
Major General Lul Roy Kong, spokesman of the South Sudan People's Defense Force, says he is yet to see the report, but doubts it contains anything new.
I think it's the same old one, which is just put in a new bottle. The same thing we have been talking about, A, B, C, D, E, but when we get down to ground, we normally find all the accusations to be untrue. We just had a report list and the government formed its own investigation committee. They went on the ground. They tried to correlate what was released with what the reality on the ground, and it was discovered that it was just a pile of lies.
Still, Gabriel says his group will ensure that any of its soldiers found guilty of the alleged atrocities will be held accountable.
Whoever is responsible for doing anything wrong, if he is brought up and is found guilty, yes, he can be judged by the court and he can be indicted. If he has to be indicted, we cannot go against the law.
The UN Human Rights Investigating Body says despite mounting evidence, the South Sudanese government has taken no real steps towards accountability. And the reports say South Sudanese leaders have made no progress on the long-promised hybrid court for South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
Zimbabwe's biggest annual carnival, the Harare International Festival of the Arts, has become a casualty of the country's economic difficulties. Reporter Kuzai Navashi has the details.
The festival, known as Haifa, have confirmed that the 2019 edition will not take place. It says it cannot responsibly commit to presenting an event of the same quality and impact that it has been known for while Zimbabwe deals with many important issues, both social and economic. Mukudzei Majoni is a comedian and often hosts such events. Referring to the country's currency crisis and general shortage of extra cash, he says he can understand Haifa's decision.
Things are bad. Things are bad. You cannot even host an event because how do you charge? In US dollars, in bond notes, most people try not to have events until Zimbabwe is a currency again, as the rumors are saying. Arts and culture being on the totem pole of Zimbabwean activities has fallen down, further down in the pecking order of things that people want to use their disposable income for.
Munashe Chokoza is an entertainment reporter who has covered Haifa in the past. He says the absence of the country's biggest festival will have an impact.
It's a big blow to the arts industry and as well to the nation, because Haifa was a platform where a lot of upcoming artists as well as established artists would showcase their talent to a wider audience from all over the world. The government needs to do something to make sure that Haifa comes back.
He adds that in light of the government's efforts to rebuild Zimbabwe, ensuring that Haifa remains on the festival calendar may be one way to boost confidence in the country. Chokoza says Haifa's absence this year robs hundreds of artists of income and thousands more who could have gained employment from the festival. Zimbabwean creative Alex Moringani says Haifa's absence will affect creativity.
It just brings us dry spells, and I feel like it just dampens the spirit of art and creativity in the country. It will be missed, and you can't talk of Harare without a Haifa.
Haifa is not the only festival to be hit hard. A monthly wine and blanket festival called Unplugged recently announced it will host only three events this year. Zimbabwe is facing a series of economic challenges led by currency distortion. The government says the value of a local currency, bond notes, is equal to the US dollar. But in the market, the US dollar's value is three times higher than the bond note. And yet, the majority of citizens are paid in the local currency. For VOA, this is Kudzai Navashe from Harare.
Albinos in Malawi are asking the government to declare the country unsafe for them and to help them seek asylum in other countries. Malawi's Albino Association says the continued killings of albinos over the false belief that their body parts are magic has made life too dangerous. In the past month alone, three albinos have been attacked, including a 14-year-old boy who was abducted. Lamek Masina reports from the town of Deza.
Mese Maulidi's 14-year-old albino boy, Goodson, was abducted early morning on February 12 by armed thugs. Maulidi says the thugs forced her way into her house, claiming to be inspectors of the forestry department.
Adobala and Maroji.
She says the thugs came with flashlights. Each one of them wore helmets. She failed to recognize their faces because they were looking down. They immediately grabbed her child while he was sleeping and covered his mouth so that he could not scream. Maulidi grabbed her 10-year-old daughter, Faith, also albino, and ran, screaming for help. But armed with knives, the thugs hacked anyone who tried to rescue the boy. Sitifano Chiwaya is the uncle of the abducted child. He says the thugs switched off their flashlights and one of them aimed a machete at his head. But when he tried to avoid it, the knife landed on his cheek. Police arrested three suspects, including the boy's stepfather. Albinos are born without the skin pigment, melanin, giving them a very light skin and hair that make them stand out in African societies. People who have the genetic condition are often killed in Malawi because of the false belief that their body parts used in potions or rituals will bring good luck and wealth. Malawi's Albino Association says authorities have failed to protect them and says it is time they help albinos move to safer countries. Rosin Sope is a member of the Malawi Albino Association. She says they have lost trust in anyone, even in their close friends, even people they are staying with, because most of the attacks are arranged by those they live with or even friends. The United Nations has warned that if attacks continue, Malawi's 15,000 albinos could one day be wiped out. Malawi's authorities acknowledge the problem, but say encouraging the albinos to leave the country is not an answer. Heather Wikintaba is the chairperson of the Presidential Committee to Protect the Albinos.
Now, how do we change those mindsets? It's very, very difficult, but I believe the police are doing the best that they can.
But Malawi's albinos and their supporters are losing faith in authorities. Last year in southern Malawi, a doctor, a police officer, and a priest were charged with killing a 22-year-old albino man. As police continue to search for her son, Maulidi fears the worst for the fate of her 14-year-old son and also for her daughter. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Dedza, Malawi.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A new study says rape is not only a weapon of war in Cameroon's separatist conflict, but also that many victims are terminating pregnancies with cruel, unsafe abortion techniques. Former DRC President Joseph Kabila's once ruling coalition Wednesday signed an agreement pledging to uphold internal cohesion and recognize Mr. Kabila as the moral authority of the coalition. The once-ruling Common Front for Congo coalition holds the majority of seats in the Congolese parliament as a result of last December's presidential election. The agreement came a few days after former President Kabila held talks with President Felix Tshisekedi. And a court in Rwanda Wednesday ruled that the auction of the Rigara Family Tobacco Company property conducted by the Rwanda Revenue Authority was legal. Last year, the Revenue Authority auctioned off machinery, equipment, and stocks belonging to the Premier Tobacco Company to recover over $6.9 million in back taxes. And that's it for this Thursday, February 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll examine the elections in Nigeria and Senegal. Nigerians are electing a president and a national assembly, and voters in Senegal are deciding who is going to be their next president. An in-depth discussion on the Nigerian and Senegalese elections.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty of VOA Africa. I am in Nigeria to cover the general election. Listen to my daily report when you tune in to our news shows. Africa News Tonight, Daybreak Africa, Nightline Africa, and International Edition for the latest from Lagos.